Matthew 11, verses 28 through 30. Come to me, all you who are weary, Jesus says, speaking to a crowd of people, told that whenever he would see the crowd, that he saw them as sheep without a shepherd, that he had great compassion upon them. And here Jesus puts out this incredible invitation, an invitation that I want us to think as we're reading this, that this is not an invitation that was spoken solely to an audience 2,000 years ago, but there is an eternal reality to this invitation. It's an invitation that speaks to us right where we're at. It's an invitation that addresses the great anxieties of the human soul, the restlessness that most of us, all of us, will experience at some point or another, many of us experience on a daily basis. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest. And take my yoke. And how does he give rest? Does he provide a bed? Does he provide an easy chair? No, he provides a yoke. And what do we use a yoke to do? To work. Take my work upon you, essentially, and learn from me. For I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke, my work is easy, and my burden is light. Let's pray. Jesus, we do pray right now that you would open up our hearts and minds to this beautiful passage, a passage that brings the center to our human experience. It brings balance to our need for rest, not just external rest, not leisure and vacation, but our need for rest in the soul, a need for work, a value for work that would fill out the work that we do tangibly in this world, that would give us purpose and meaning and drive, and remind us, Lord, that though the things that we might do may have moments of great tedium, that the promise of this great invitation is that when you are in the midst, when you are in the center of our experience, you bring eternal value to everything that we do. That you bring us rest in the midst of our exhaustion. That you bring value to the work that we sometimes find valueless. That you bring peace in an age in which so few actually experience it. And Lord, I pray from the outset that you would forgive us for our restlessness, for allowing ourselves to be defined not by you, but by the anxieties of our culture, of our society, of our world, for looking to the things that we experience with our senses as something that is worth striving for, and placing what is ultimate and supreme upon things that will only leave us more empty than before we started. Lord, forgive us for these things and transform us from the inside out. And Jesus, I pray that right now you would speak to us by your Holy Spirit. For I myself, as much as anyone, maybe even more, need your rest, your peace, that we might know how to live fully for you, drawing our energy from you. Thank you that you are the Lord of the Sabbath. It's in your name we pray. Amen. Well, guys, today we're going to be talking about the two disciplines that derive their health from one source, and that is Jesus. But we're going to look at the discipline of work and rest. And, you know, it's interesting, as I was working on this message, that this message would come the week that one of my favorite childhood stars would commit suicide, Robin Williams. And I was struck by an observation of how people are so devastated, so rocked by suicide of our stars. When I was living in Seattle in the 90s, I remember just the insane mourning that took place in my city over the suicide of Kurt Cobain, and I remember the water fountain under the Space Needle, walking by it, and just like hundreds of people, like just they didn't even know him, just weeping in the middle of this water fountain, standing in the water fountain, weeping. And I think of the hurt and the heartache over even this week, and even my daughter, who's, you know, only reference for Robin Williams was Mrs. Doubtfire, and she says, "Dad, did you hear that Mrs. Doubtfire died?" And I'm like, "No, honey, Mork died. Mork died today." For me, I remember first grade, Mork and Mindy was my favorite television show. So much so that I had a Mork and Mindy lunch pail. I had the rainbow striped suspenders with the buttons on them that I wore to school every day with my high-waisted rough skins. Those were the days. And, you know, I was thinking about this with why is it is it because we've seen them in so many things that we feel like we know them? I don't believe that's why we're so troubled. I believe that it is an absolute and utter violation of our humanistic thinking. Because Robin Williams and Kurt Cobain and the multitudes who have given up what we have set as the ultimate in achievement for human existence, that they could make it all the way to the top and achieve what none of us will ever achieve, that they could accomplish and have the accolades and the praise of people, that Robin Williams has left behind a legacy in which people will remember him much longer. As Tim talked about last year, we don't even remember the names of our great-grandfathers, but we do remember the names of stars. We could speak of stars that died. We know who Charlie Chaplin is. There are people that put their mark on the world, that leave an indelible etch in the human consciousness. And Robin Williams was one of those guys. I mean, he had this incredible career of both comedy, serious roles, Good Will Hunting. We think of all these things that he did, and he was this, what was made it so devastating with him. I mean, Kurt Cobain, it was almost you saw the writing on the wall before it even came, because he wore his despair so outwardly. But Williams was a man of laughter who gave incredible sums of money to help kids with cancer. I mean, how many movies did you go to in the 90s that showed those commercials of calling people to donate, to stop, to help create cures for cancer for children? I mean, Williams was known for all of these things, and yet, with all that he's accomplished, with all that he did for society, and all the praise, all the money, all of it, the best he could do at the end of his life is hang himself by a belt. And it's disturbing at best. And it causes us, why we're so upset about it, isn't because we care that much about him, honestly. It's because it's an offense to what many of us are striving for and will never achieve. It's a reminder that you can make it all the way and still live absolutely desperate. And what's challenging for us as Christians is that we act as if we're somehow protected from this kind of restlessness and this kind of despair. But unfortunately, because we are so shaped by the society and the culture that we live in, we bring that grid of secularism right into the heart of our Christianity, and we allow it to distort and pervert the purity of the gospel. And in doing so, instead of reflecting to the world what it looks like to have found peace, we reflect the same kind of anxiousness and restlessness and interior boredom that plagues the soul and creates despair. We have the same kind of elements that bring these realities into our lives, and we don't know what to do with it. I find it in myself, that kind of restless soul where I'm like, "Lord, I need peace. And what is it that's driving me? Why am I lacking peace?" How many of you can say, like I am saying right now, that peace is the thing that is lacking in your life? A restlessness of your experience. And so when we think about work and we think about rest, we have misconceptions that work is the means by which we achieve what we see our celebrities achieve, Work is the means by which we provide comfort for our lives and a future for our children and retirement when we're too old to work any longer. Work is now based solely in what is brought to the temporal. And rest is not derived from a desire to be united with Christ or a desire to be in communion with God, but rest is merely a means of recovering from the burnout that so often we experience. Rest for us is a vacation from the strain of work. But I want to share with you right now that this passage turns that concept upside down on its head. And it tells us that Jesus wants to bring a new kind of meaning to work, because he says, those of you who are weary, and that would be everyone, he says, those of you who are restless, and that would be all of us at some point, he says, you come to me, and I'm going to give you a new meaning of work. I'm going to give you my work. Because he says, I'm going to give you my yoke. And a yoke was a device that was created to sit on the back of an oxen, and it was meant to not hinder the oxen's ability to plow the field. It was actually meant to distribute the load that the oxen was to carry in a way that the labor would be manageable, that the labor would be fulfilled. And what's powerful about the illustration is Jesus, as a carpenter, had to have known the ins and outs. He possibly even made yokes. I mean, it's very possible there would. And anyone who knows anything about how a yoke works on oxen, I'm sure all of us have a working knowledge of yokes, but I'm going to tell you right now because I looked at, you know, WikiWorks. And the slightest burr in a wood yoke would be enough to cripple an oxen within hours. A burr on its shoulder pushing down on a particular nerve could cause its left leg to collapse. And so it had to be of perfect construct in order for it to be effective in distributing that weight properly. And so Jesus says, take my yoke. Jesus, being the one whom we can truly trust, I would say that it is only when we fit ourselves to his yoke that we can begin to enter into our work, into the grind of life, and experience at the same time rest. See, I don't believe that this idea of work and rest is about working and then not working. I think this is about working from a place of interior peace. That's what Jesus is concerned with. And he wants to fill out our understanding of this because, you guys, we live in an age which we are driven. Many of you sitting here right now, your work is a source of absolute tedium. You hate it. You find no value in it. You don't know how to draw meaning from it. And for you, the work week is about getting through to the weekend. But what is a struggle is that when you live like that, then the weekend is just a reminder of the fact that you got to go back on Monday. And that kind of grind is what creates, I think, like an internal strife that defines much of our modern age. In fact, there is a book that I don't know why I keep going back to it again and again and again. And I think it's because I think that this man captures so fully and is so willing to look head on into the despair of the modern man's existence. It's a man by the name of Fernando Pessoa. You probably have not heard of him, but he's Portugal's most beloved poet. And in his lifetime, he only published probably two poems. And I said in the last service that they found a chest after he died of 25,000 volumes. That was an overstatement on accident. It was actually 2,500 volumes of work, poems and different writings, and that he just wrote endlessly without even putting it out there for people. And one of the great works, the most complete and fullest work, is a book he wrote called The Book of Disquiet. Doesn't that sound uplifting? The Book of Disquiet. And I want to read a passage from it because I think Pessoa gives us the most honest look at the absolute restlessness of our age. And this was written almost 100 years ago, and it's utterly prophetic in the realms of despair. He says this, and here's the thing that he'll do for us, is that he will define for you things that you have felt but have never thought to actually put into words, because we have the ability to escape these kinds of terrifying realities by going to movies like, yes, Guardians of the Galaxy. He chose to sit in it. Most of us will not do that. And he says, life is an experimental journey undertaken involuntarily. Freedom would mean rest. Notice that. He recognizes that if I was to be truly free, I would have to be restful. He says, my past is everything I never managed to become. I have lived so much without ever having lived. I have thought so much without ever having thought. I am sick of what I never had nor will have. I bear in my body wounds of all the battles I have not fought. My muscles are weary efforts I have never even considered making. At the end of this day, there remains what remained yesterday and what will remain tomorrow, the insatiable, unquantifiable longing to be both the same and other. I want to continue to be myself, but I want to be better. I want to be different. I realize that I am always sad, however content or happy I may often feel. It's like having a cold in the soul. Anguished desire, disquiet that is always growing and always the same. Everything interests me, and yet nothing holds my attention. I bought this book for all of you, and you can pick it up at the door. No, but Josh is morbid. He has... My wife goes, why do you read these things? And I read them because it gives me insight into what I'm dealing with on a weekly basis when people sit in my office in absolute brokenness and they can't even figure out how to start with Jesus. And this is what our age has given us. This is the secularism that has defined our existence. I'm setting this up with a little bit of psychology and a little bit of philosophy, because we have come so far from what was the normal human experience 200 years ago that we have created literally a new option for existence, for driving meaning from existence, that 200 years ago would never even have been thought about. In 1500, atheism literally, it didn't even exist. It was unheard of. It was so minimal. But through the Age of Enlightenment and into our modern age of the 20th century on into postmodernism, there were developments. And I'm reading a book right now basically by this guy. I bought this philosopher's book called The Secular Age, which is like a 900-page tome, and I started reading it and realized that I'm stupid and had no idea what he was talking about, but I liked lots of words that he used. And so instead, Tim said, hey, man, I actually just read this book by this professor who wrote a 160-page book explaining the 900-page book. And he goes, and I realized this gives me more time to escape into those films that I need to after reading things like this. But James Smith wrote a book called How Not to Be Secular, rereading Charles Taylor. But what he says is that Taylor has five basic premises that have developed the very world that we live in as Westerners, and why Christianity is so difficult for so many Christians. And he says that, first of all, the secular age, because so many of we don't really know what secular means, but all secularism is it's an attempt to create significance and meaning apart from the divine, without any reference to anything divine. To define and create for ourselves significance out of what we experience with our senses. And he says the first move in secularism, and this is why work is so hard for so many and why rest never comes to us, is it was a move away from life being, its meaning being derived from the world, to meaning of life being derived through the mind. In other words, it was a move away from Our exterior defines our existence. To know you define your existence. Your mind is the only thing that's ultimately real. This is part of our modern age. It's a gift to you and I that has become one of the great curses, that I am the most important thing in my universe. The only thing is real is what I say is real. It's how we've come to those conclusions. What is true for me may not be true for you. Which brings me to the second thing that he says is driven secularism, which is it is a move away from society or community or the good of mankind to the good of the individual. We have moved away from words. Our grandparents used language like us, we, the people. Now it's me. So that our parents gave us the me generation, and we as Gen X and millennials have entered into the look at me generation. It's a whole move, a trend toward the individual is the center of meaning as well as importance. Third, he says that morality, there was a shift in morality. There was an age, even our country's founding fathers, even though many of them were not, if not most of them, were not actually Christians, they still derived great meaning and significance from the Judeo-Christian ethics. This is why our courthouses had the Ten Commandments in front of most of them, and there has been a tremendous move in our culture to actually eradicate that. Because if we can eradicate, if we can define significance apart from any kind of divine moral rule, then we are free. And it is Christianity that has brought a great tyranny over our lives. And so this move away from moral absolutes toward a moral ambiguity, I define now what is right and wrong. And Charles Taylor calls it the lowering of the bar. I think that's good. Oh, you can't achieve that? Well, just bring it down real low. And then you can say what is right and wrong. And you can see how these things impact the way that we go about our daily business. If I am the inventor of my own reality, if I am the most important thing in my reality, if I define what is right and wrong, think about the way that this impacts our vision of work and purpose. Because then you just quit whenever you're unhappy. Because happiness, of course, is the most important thing in life. Four, time is driven no longer by an eternal perspective, but by the ticking of the clock by which we either fail to achieve or achieve our goals. Time now is the great tyrant of our existence. Because we don't have eternal perspective often. We're driven by, if I don't do this by this time, then I lose this. Or I just need to get through this time so I can get to this. You can see how it just creates an incredible tyranny in life. And then fifth, a move away from the idea of cosmos to the idea of universe. Cosmos representing that which is mysterious and unknown and goes beyond the bounds of what we can see and experience, to universe, which is now explained and confined by the realms of science. These things affect how you look at life, whether you want it to or not. And so we come back to Jesus and we see that he was dealing already with a natural inclination of the human heart to set its life and its existence upon what can be experienced with the senses, and is derived from that great, tremendous Christian doctrine we call sin, which is the brokenness and the rebellion of humanity and the rejection of God's sovereign rule as well as his grace. And we are left with a meaninglessness and a despair in our daily existence. And what my prayer is today is that we would, if we can't correct these kinds of thinking if we don't know that they're there. Some of you have experienced so much restlessness and you're just frustrated by your Christian experience because you thought that because you look at the world through these realms that have created secularism, you've applied it to Jesus and said, if Jesus was real, he would make me happy. He would give me what I want. He would give me the perfect soulmate that would be always romantic like The Notebook. You know, he would satisfy my every need and want and whim. Jesus would be essentially here to fulfill our hedonistic desires. But you see, the Sabbath, which I want us to consider now, was created, if I can borrow a phrase from Joshua Abraham Heschel, the Jewish thinker, the Sabbath was to help us escape what he calls the thinginess of existence. I really like that, the thinginess. And I had a guy who came up to me after the last gathering who is a psychologist, and he said there actually is a word for that in psychology. It's called the hedonic treadmill. I like that, which is hedonist treadmill, which is that you're driven by what is next, what is next, what can I get my hands on next? And this is why we are angry that Robin Williams killed himself, because we're trying so hard to get where he got, and we're never going to get there, and we know it. And yet he got there and he says it's horrible. He got to the end and said, you guys, there's not a treasure at the end of the rainbow. It's actually even more despairing. But we think, well, maybe he was wrong. Maybe it was just something chemical. But you guys, it's the nature of our culture. So I come back to the words of Jesus, and Jesus offers us a new reality, a new construct. He offers us rest. And in order to understand where Jesus is working from, we've got to go back to the beginning of the Bible. So look at Genesis chapter 2 with me. Genesis chapter 2. Verses 2 and 3. Here we have, in Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, God has created all that is. 6 days, and it says, by the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. Then God blessed the seventh day, and he made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. So first of all, we have to ask the question, what is the Sabbath? And then we need to ask the question, okay, the Sabbath means to cease from activity. God here finishes his work. What does that mean, that he finished his work? Because Jesus said something interesting when he entered on the scene. He goes, the Son of Man is working, and the Father has been working up till now. So what did the Father need? Was God weary? Was the rest driven by a weariness from the work? So we need to rethink our categories of rest. Is the Sabbath about getting replenished because we're worn out? Is God worn out? What does the psalmist tell us about God? That he is never what? Weary, and he never sleeps. That is my kind of man. God did not need to pause, but he chose to pause. He chose to cease what he was doing. And there is something that's incredible, because he does it. Not only does he cease, which means that all it means is that he is satisfied with what he had done. And what did he create on the sixth day, guys? Humanity. Humanity. The central piece of the created order, what God puts at the center of this beautiful garden, is humanity. Our first parents, who alone in all of the created order are created in God's image. And now he's like, he ceases what he's doing. Why? Because what did Jesus say about the Sabbath? You guys think, actually, in all three synoptic gospels, Jesus says that man is not created for the Sabbath. The Sabbath, God's rest, was created for what? For man. He ceased from his activity so that he could give himself to us. And what's beautiful about this passage is that it defines for us something fascinating, because the first thing that we see is that God, he rests, then he blesses, and then he makes holy. And he doesn't do it to a place. He doesn't even do it to a people. He does it to time. Because the Sabbath is interesting. In Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, there is no end to this day. All the other days of creation, it says, and there was morning and there was evening. But there is an eternal reality to this day, the seventh day, the day in which God ceased because he was satisfied with what he had created, and he ceased that he might enter into that satisfaction which he, in his sovereign will, decreed to limit his own activity that he might engage, enter into our world, into our place, giving us his creation. All things belong to him, we're told the scriptures, and yet God gives us the right to be his covenant partners. He places us at the center of his creation and says, this is what I have ceased to do. I haven't ceased from my activity because I'm wiped out and I just need to go to sleep so I can pretend I don't exist. Which is interesting. Pessoa constantly talks about the only time he feels rest is when he's asleep, because when he's asleep, it's as if he doesn't exist. How sad and tragic that is. No, God's ceasing is not selfish in its motivation. It is not for the purpose of refueling because he's burnt out, but in the full energy of life itself, as the author of life, it is for the purpose of relationship and communion with humanity. And see, Jesus, what I love about this is that Jesus, it says God here finishes his work. What did Jesus say on the cross? It is what? Finished. Was that the last thing that Jesus said on the cross? No, it was not. One more statement after he declared the words, it is finished, and it is, Father, into your hands I rest. I commit my spirit. Jesus finishes a work, the Lord of the Sabbath's fill, and enters into rest, which becomes our blessing. And so what we have here again and again, it's always about God. All we can say about God is what God has chosen to reveal about himself, and everything he chooses to reveal about himself from our perspective has to do directly with what he thinks about us and his interest and concern for us. You see, what I want us to understand is this Sabbath is not about the solemnness of exhaustion. It's about the celebration of what life is all about, what gives life its fill, what makes work when it's hard and horrible meaningful, what makes the layoff, which is so stressful for some of you who are just laid off, you can't even find work, and you're just like, what about me? I mean, does it say that a man who doesn't work is worse than an unbeliever? Think of the context, it's talking about a man who chooses to refuse to live for the good of others. It doesn't talk about people who have entered into a society that just simply doesn't have a job for them. How do we find meaning in life when life dishes us a hand that is just challenging and difficult, where you're not making enough to pay your bills, where you're worried about how you're going to feed your family, when you don't know how you're going to get your car fixed to get to work? What are you going to do when work, you're making plenty of money, but work is just taking over your entire life, and you're a workaholic, and you're working for the next thing, and you're driven by debt? What are you going to do when your rest is constantly recovery and never rejoicing? We've got to come back to a right meaning. We need a fill for what it is that life is about. And so God establishes something that was meant to be understood by us, and that is the first thing he makes holy is time. And what makes it holy is his presence in it with us. This is what brings value and a robustness and a fullness to our lives. The Sabbath, and this is what I love, is that God sets a limit to his activity and thus to his creation as well. And here is the profound thing. Time was intended for this day, because it is the day in which God committed himself to man and to his creation. And what's powerful about it is that I want you guys to see this, because this is a profound reality for us, is that this Sabbath is not meant to be used for rejuvenation. This Sabbath is meant to bring us freedom, to bring us rest, perpetual rest, which is the center. What I mean by that is shalom, peace, to our restless souls, and joy, not happiness. Happiness is fleeting. It's the great lie of the American dream. Jesus never said, I've come to give you joy. My joy is complete, and I want your joy to remain with you, or happiness to remain. He says, my joy is meant, something internal that brings satisfaction even when life is extremely hard and painful. It's a different kind of thinking. Now, I want you to jump forward with me to Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 through 11, because here, the Sabbath, that seventh day of rest, is now given to the children of Israel. Israel, now a nation, about to inherit their land, and God gives to Moses the law by which they were to live. And many of us have a misconception around law. We think that the law was simply given to show how sinful humanity is. That is not why the law was given. In fact, we're told that the law is good. And Paul says, if I had not known the law, I would not have known what sin is. But the law wasn't given just to show us what sin is. Jesus says that I did not come to destroy the law or the prophets. He came to what? Fulfill the law. He fulfills it. He gives it its full, robust meaning. But the law here is given to create parameters. It's like a parent with their child. There are rules that are given to create the greatest amount of freedom and safety for your child's development. This is why the law was given. It was given so that the children of Israel would have the means by which they could practice relationship and intimacy with Yahweh. And in the fourth command, Exodus chapter 20, verses 8 and 11, it says, remember the Sabbath day by keeping it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the Sabbath day is the Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor your male or female servant, nor your animals, nor any foreigner residing in your towns. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. And this is the thing, from a Christian perspective, the Sabbath day may have been the last day of the week, but it was not, it was the last day. It's the seventh day for God, but it was the first day for humanity. It was the first day for humanity. Heschel is very quick to point out that the Sabbath was not the goal of the week. It was the Sabbath is the power of the whole week, because it reminds us that our existence is not derived, and our value and purpose is not derived by what we achieve with our hands, but that what we do with our hands and where we go with our feet and what we say with our lips and the things that we give ourselves to, that the Sabbath fills that with meaning, no matter what you're doing. If you're a plumber, if you're an electrician, if you're a teacher, if you're a parent, which is the hardest work of any work that any of us can do, if you're laid off or you're a CEO at a multi-million-dollar company, it does not matter. We are all called as Christians to derive our value not from the thing that we're doing, but from the one whom we live for, who brings value and meaning to those various fields of existence, so that our work, regardless of what it is, becomes an act of practical worship. If any of you have ever read the book, The Practicing of His Presence, what's powerful about that little book that by this monk, Brother Lawrence, who was crippled and was a dishwasher in a monastery, essentially said that he found great satisfaction because everything he did, he learned to do it unto the Lord as if Jesus is there with him. And it wasn't as if Jesus was there with him. He believed the scriptures when it says, and lo, I am with you always, and therefore found more satisfaction and joy than apparently Robin Williams did in all of his successes and accomplishments. You see, this is the purpose of Sabbath. Sabbath is not our rest and our work. Some of you work all the time to avoid being alone with your thoughts. Some of you never work because you have grown apathetic in your heart because you don't see the value in the work, and therefore you don't even have rest. Neither side is the right way to live. The right way to live is to work with a full understanding that my life derives its energy and its resources from my Creator, that this life is temporary and short, and I want to make everything serve the kingdom no matter what it is that I'm doing. My rest is not a time for me to just recuperate, although we do need times to rejuvenate. I'm not saying that it's wrong to need to be refreshed, but what I'm saying is that it's not an escape from reality, but it's a time to become reunited with the living God, to be reminded of what the purpose of existence is, because we forget so fast, so fast. We are on the hedonic treadmill. I am just as much as you are. I've already been totally convinced that I need the newest iPhone, and I don't, because mine is fine. But I want the flatter version, you know? It's like, why? Like, who cares? Like, why do we need the newest car? Why do we need the newest thing? We do have a condition of thinginess. And what it is, it's driven by what Pessoa called a cold in the soul. Just all snotty and gross. And we need to get healthy because the world is looking to us for answers, and we have to actually live a life that tangibly plays out that answer. When he says that 6 days you will work, it reminds us that work is not a part of the fall. Work was a part of God's good design. That's what we see in Genesis 1:28, that God blessed them and God said to them, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. It was like, till the land, take care of it, prune the trees. You got to work. The sin brought toil into work. So that now work is done by the sweat of the brow, that now everything we do in our work is off, it will be touched by mixture. This is why we need Sabbath, a Sabbath understanding. Not an actual day in which we don't do anything, which some people have interpreted that we should be actually practicing Sabbath. I would argue that we see no evidence of that in the early church. We do not see it ever required of Gentiles in the New Testament, because here is what I want us to move toward, and this will bring together this concept of both work and rest. In this passage, in both Genesis and in the opening passage in Matthew 11, as well as Exodus chapter 20. What we see is that the gospel is present in the Sabbath. What are we told? That God ceased from his work on the seventh day, and he rested. That is, that he engaged and entered into communion with his creation, specifically with humanity. That his seventh day becomes our first day. And what is the gospel? How does the gospel differ from religion? Religion says, live like this, work hard, and God will accept you. The gospel says, God has accepted you in Jesus, now live like this. So our work comes out of his work. He is the initiator of it. He is the one who completed it and was satisfied with it. And he invites us to work from the position of rest. This is why for Christians, the seventh day became the first day for us. The first day of the week became the Lord's day, because Jesus is the fill of the Sabbath. If God in Genesis makes time holy, what makes time holy is God's presence there, and its full fulfillment is in Jesus Christ. And listen to this passage. What does it say in Hebrews chapter 4, verses 9 and 11? There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from their works, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter into that rest. That rest. And how did Jesus define rest in Matthew 11? By doing his what? His work. And what does it say here? We're to work to enter into the rest, which means that Jesus recognizes, the writers of the New Testament recognize, that the greatest challenge for a broken, sinful people is the disciplining of our devotion to Jesus and his mission, to remind ourselves that rest is not something we are working toward, it's something we are working from, because rest no longer is simply time sanctified, but it is Jesus, the Lord of the Sabbath, as he called himself, who fills that holy time and is available to each one of us at every moment of every day. But we must exercise our hearts and our minds toward a deeper awareness of God's availability to our lives, or our work will create despair, and our worklessness will create despair, and our rest will create despair and boredom, and we will continue to press into what I believe is our society's natural inclination toward escapism on every level. We just sedate ourselves with distractions because everything interests us, but nothing holds our attention. And Jesus wants to hold our attention, and that requires a disposition of humility and a willingness to come. It's so fascinating that all Jesus asks of us is that we would just simply come to him. And some of us spin our wheels all around the perimeters of the Christian life. I'm going to try to stop swearing. I'm going to try to stop smoking. I'm going to try to, you know, go to church more. I'm going to try to read my Bible more. And all along this realm of frustration, of religious living, Jesus sits at the center waiting to be wanted. And he calls to us who are weary, and he says, come to me and I'll give you rest. I'm not going to give you a bed. I'm going to give you a new kind of work, a new meaning for your work, whatever it is that you do. What a powerful and profound reality for us that's available. You guys, some of you are restless today, and Jesus is calling to you and he's saying, I love you. Why are you so weary? Why do you continue to chase after things that will break your heart? He challenges the things that we live for. He calls us to live in a place of absolute dependence upon him. You know what's fascinating? You know what follows in Hebrews upon the very heels of this text in Hebrews chapter 4? What comes in verse 12? After we're told that that we are to strive to enter that rest, what does it say? And how do we do that? For the word of God is powerful. It's sharper than any two-edged sword, and it has the ability to cut through the lies that we build up and the gods that we place in our lives. It cuts through all that garbage, and it shows us who we really are without him and what we can be in him. And it's scary, but it is exciting. And I can promise you that when you begin to allow your mind to be shaped by the scriptures and by Jesus Christ, who is the Lord of the Sabbath, who the scriptures points to, it gives us a whole new way of looking at the world. And it gives us hope in the midst of hopelessness. And it gives us power and authority in an age of relativism where people don't even know what to believe because their own foolish minds are incapable of producing a satisfactory way of living. So shall we be defined by the gospel, or shall we be defined by our hedonistic treadmill that many of us are on as we listen to the lies of our secular age? The difference between the sacred and the secular, there's all this conversation about that. There's no distinction. Yes, there is. But when we put Jesus at the center of our thoughts, it makes every moment sacred. For the Sabbath is without evening and without day. It is the never-ending presence of a God who cares about you. Amen? Let's pray.